Microfinance, giving small loans to the poor so they can invest in the tools they need to improve their lives, has been touted as the way to end poverty forever. In 2006, Bangladeshi banker Mohammed Yunus and the Grameen Bank received the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts through microcredit to create economic and social development from below. It's a cause that's been promoted by celebrities, and in the past 40 years, it has grown into a multi-billion dollar industry. But like any investment business, microfinance is susceptible to fraud and abuse. Hugh Sinclair has worked in microfinance for the past decade on five continents, and that experience led him to be a whistleblower. In his book, Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor, he describes some of the microfinance institutions he's worked for as frauds and Ponzi schemes, the new loan sharks siphoning wealth from the poor to rich investors. In part one of an extended interview, Sinclair says microfinance is really an extremely good idea and has proved to be effective in isolated cases.
The problem is that the image that is presented to the outside world is overly romanticized. This idea of the woman with the goat or with the sewing machine furiously working her way out of poverty thanks to a $100 loan is frankly just way over romanticized. The unfortunate reality is that a large amount of microfinance doesn't end up anywhere near any sort of entrepreneurial activity whatsoever. Depending on the estimates that you examine, people suggest that somewhere between 50 and up to 90% of microfinance is actually just spent on consumption, just like any credit card. It's also used a lot for refinancing loans. So a large part of the microfinance capital which is lent out there is being borrowed from Bank A to simply repay Bank B. So this idea of harnessing the entrepreneurial flair, if that were the case, we'd probably see a much better result than we do so far. And the proof of this is that the academic literature to date is mediocre at best, suggesting that microfinance is really not having very much of an impact on poverty, if any.
You report interest rates of 100% are not uncommon, and up to 195% in the case of one Mexican lender. What's the regulation on these microfinance institutions? Are they under any kind of controls at all?
Well, it's a valid question because it varies a lot from country to country. So if you look at a country such as Ecuador, then there are very tight regulations, and the highest interest rate that anyone is allowed to charge is 30.5%. And this is rigidly enforced by the central bank. If you look at a country such as Mexico, there is no such legislation. And if you look at Africa, there's very little legislation protecting the customers over extortionate interest rates. And even where there are regulations, often they're very poorly enforced. But the highest rate that I've come across so far is Compartamos in Mexico, which was confirmed by noted U.S. academic David Rudman at the Center for Global Development, that when you take into account all the costs, all the hidden fees and the impact of various different savings and things, that the overall interest rate was about 195%. So we're not talking rates which can easily be compared to what we would find in the United States or Europe, not at all. And this partially explains why it's so difficult for the poor to work their way out of poverty when they're having to service loans of such eye-wateringly high interest rates.
What are the consequences for the borrowers?
If you look at the academic literature regarding the impact on poverty, it's not very convincing. People have suggested that it's zero, that there's no net impact. Some people suggest that it's marginally negative. The most optimistic report suggests that if it has any positive impact, it's negligible. But the impact for the borrowers is that they are given a hope, a dream. You know, they're told, you know, if you work, if you invest this money, if you work hard, you'll get out of poverty. And they do. That's precisely what they do. They often do very labor-intensive, backbreaking work. You know, stacking shelves, working in farms, working in little allotments. You know, desperately trying to earn enough money to get out of poverty. The problem is that any net returns which they make invariably are spent on servicing the loans. So the impact is very little. That's on average. If we look at some of the worst cases, there have been some atrocities, particularly most recently in the Andhra Pradesh region of India, where very aggressive debt collection techniques have actually led now to 54 women committing suicide just under the sheer pressure of being unable to service their loans as interest rates just accumulated and accumulated and accumulated. Eventually, they just gave up. So we've had 54 cases of suicide in one region, in one country, documented so far. But also cases of women being forced into prostitution in order to service loans, of children being kidnapped as collateral for loans. And I don't want to suggest that that is normal. These are fortunately extremely exceptional cases. But in the worst case, microfinance can simply push people to despair and to suicide. And that is a terrible blight on our collective conscience.
I hear interest rates of 20 to 35%, and I think that's incredible. I would never keep a credit card at a rate like that. How do they get away with that?
Well, it's amazing that if you look at the crisis that's currently sweeping over the whole of Europe, the media will say if the Spanish interest rates reach 7%, this is the alarm bell. This is the moment when servicing a debt becomes impossible and that we could actually have a sovereign default of Spain. And yet we turn around and expect the poor to pay 195% interest a year. It's actually ridiculous when you think about it. But for as long as the interest rates are not publicized, then no one really needs to know about it. It's extremely profitable at 195%. That is the problem. And the other thing is, let's not forget, many of these clients, not only are they not protected by a regulator in their local countries, but often they're not as financially aware as we are in the United States and in Europe. And even in the United States and Europe, people have got into substantial trouble by becoming over-indebted and having their debts lead them to bankruptcy. And this is with regulation and a certain degree of transparency. It's not uncommon for people in developing countries to sign a loan contract with a fingerprint because they can't read and write. They really have no idea what they're doing. And they suddenly find themselves trapped in a debt spiral, which is why we've seen a series of crises over the last decade. And it is really because of this asymmetry of power. We're lending money to vulnerable people, and they can get into trouble very quickly. Until the crisis occurs, we can make a lot of profit out of it. But when the crisis occurs, it can be very messy. Nicaragua was one of the classic cases. In Nicaragua, the entire microfinance sector collapsed a couple of years ago as a grassroots rebellion led by poor people finally just got fed up with the banks and said, you know what, this is not helping us. We can't pay these interest rates. They're far too high. We're not going to pay. When it started with 30 or so people, the banks just put the non-repaying clients into prison. But this sparked a revolt, and eventually it spread over the entire country in a movement called No Pago, I Won't Pay. And suddenly when you had a few million people refusing to pay loans, suddenly the power shifted. And what we saw was the total collapse of the microfinance sector in Nicaragua, led by the poor, the so-called beneficiaries of microfinance. So this is what happens in the extreme cases when eventually the people just say no more.
Hugh Sinclair is a consultant working in microfinance strategy and portfolio management, and he is author of Confessions of a Microfinance Heretic, How Microlending Lost Its Way and Betrayed the Poor.